Hello, everyone. So today we're going to have to go back and forth between the verses and the Mishnah again. A lot of what happens in these Mishnayot is based on a very fine reading of the verses themselves. Sure, people take this as an indication of how much a Mishnah is dependent on a fine literary reading as opposed to any other factor. I'm sure people take that as a sign of whether they are speaking from experience or speaking from their literary predilections. But you can do with that whatever you want. So last time we were talking about how much they needed to write on the scroll, and there were a bunch of different options. Some people thought that you started up here at the beginning of the priest's adjuration of the wife. And then you skip the bit where it's just instructions, then you carry on and through the whole thing. Some people thought that you started here, but you didn't skip the instructions. You just, once you started writing the verses, you just continued writing the verses and you went on. And some people thought that it only started from the last part of the thing, which is actually describing the curses themselves, as opposed to the oath that goes with it. So now we're going to continue talking about another important verse here and what exactly it means. The priest wrote these curses in a book, in a scroll. So we've already how the different Tanaim understand the phrase "these curses." Now we're going to see how they understand the words "v'chatav," and he wrote and "basefer" in a scroll. And it disintegrates, it rubs off in the bitter waters. So we're just going to see how they understood the word "maha." So that's what we're focusing on right now. So this is where we are. Lo chotev al haluach, v'lo al haniyar, v'lo al hadiftara, ela al hamagila, shenemar basefer. So the priest can't write it on a tablet or on papyrus or on leather. This translation is definitely wrong, by the way. It's not rough parchment. It's treated leather, is diphthera. It's a Greek word. It means leather in Greek. That's just what it means. It has to be on a scroll. It can only be written on a scroll, as it says, in a scroll. So they translated the word sefer to Megillah, but they mean essentially the same thing. Megillah is just a more specific term, I think, here. So it has to be a scroll in order to fulfill what the verse says, which is sefer. The scroll would also be parchment. Yes, the difference is about how much parchment. Like the nayar is just like a little bit of papyrus. A scroll has to roll up a bit. So it's also like how well it's treated as well, I think. So like nayar might be treated less. Papyrus might be treated less seriously than the Megillah, as in like the treatment to make it how nice it is. Sefer doesn't mean books for them, just to be clear. Like Sefer Torah doesn't mean a book of the Torah, it means literally a scroll of the Torah. So they didn't exactly have books yet, they just started having codices. One of the funny things that I learned was that one of the secrets between secrets of Christianity's meteoric rise during this period and later is because they embraced the new technology of the codex, which is significantly better than scrolls. Because you can just open up any page you want instead of having to roll through the entire thing. And the Jews were basically like, yeah, we're good with scrolls. not much has changed. Anyway, ve'eino chotev lo b'komos v'lo b'kan kantom v'lo b'chol davar sheroshem ela v'yadosh ne'amar umacha k'tav she'achol l'himachek. So now we're talking about what you have to write it on. Great, parchment treated sheepskin, not papyrus, which is reeds. Great, perfect. So now we're talking about what you have to write it with, the ink, what kind of ink you can have. And basically the point is that it has to be an ink which doesn't make a mark, that doesn't leave something behind in the scroll, as you'll see. So you can't write with komos, which is a type of gum, ink made from gum, or kan kantom, which is some kind of metal-based ink. Not with anything else that would leave a mark on the parchment. Ella bidyo. Rather with ink. Ink that will not leave a mark. Shne'amar umacha katav she'achol lehimachik. The whole point is that the writing has to be able to be totally disintegrated, has to be totally rubbed away. So the macha here is treated as a, if there's anything left on the parchment from what you wrote, that then the writing wasn't really macha, it wasn't really obliterated in the water. So the scroll that you put in should come out totally blank and totally free, and there should be nothing left out, no marks left on the scroll, and no imprints on the scroll either, just like the surface level writing, so that all of it washes away and the whole of the scroll becomes water soluble, as you say, Fred. Yeah, basically water soluble. Okay, so that's their fine reading of the verses in order to fulfill the instruction of Basefer and Umacha. Now we're going to get back to the curses. The end of the curses and the end of the and the oath. Sorry, back to the oath. The end of the curse and the oath is the woman says at the end, "Amen, amen." To respond to all these curses and agree to the conditions of the oath. Now we're discussing in this Mishnah. We're going to discuss what exactly is she saying "Amen" to. What is included in this "Amen"? What's included in the oath that wasn't explicitly specified? This is the also the origin of the principle that saying "Amen" to an oath is the same as making the oath yourself. So if somebody says, like, "I make you swear to do blah, blah, blah," and you say "Amen," that means you have taken the oath, essentially. And so this is the origin of that. Okay, so now we're going to see what's covered by the Sotah's oath. Omar hiomeret amen, amen. On what does she say, or about what does she say, amen, amen? Amen al ha'ala. Amen al hashvua. She agrees to the curses and she agrees to the oath. One of the things that's a bit ambiguous about the that we've already touched upon about the what the priest says to the sota is some of it is an oath and some of it is are the curses. So the amen amen. Why does it say amen twice? So we're going to go through two things that amen means. Amen that. Amen this. Amen that. Amen this. Amen that. In order to cover the two amens, and here it is. Amen on the curse part. And amen on the shvua part, on the oath part. Amen me'ish zeh, amen me'ish acher. Amen from this, from the man that her husband specifically warned her about in the warning ceremony. And amen me'ish acher, amen from another, any other man. So she's also testifying to the fact that she has not cheated on her husband with any other men, not specifically just the one that his her husband warned her about. That's the significance of the second amen here. It expands the oath. Amen shelo satiti arusan sua v'shmeret yavam uchnusa. Amen shelo nitmeti. Ve'im nitmeti yavoivi. And amen that I did not go astray as a someone who was betrothed or married or waiting for my levirate marriage after my husband died, or taken into the house of the lever. All those situations would be adultery. So she's covering all of that, not just when I was married, but also when I was engaged or when I was waiting for a lever or anything, any other bond that I had with a man. I didn't go against those bonds at any time. And also that I did not defile myself. I did not cheat at all. But if I did, then let these curses come upon me. Rabbi Meir has a slightly different understanding of the amen, amen. So the first Tana thinks that amen, amen is about expanding the things that she is talking about, that the first amen covers the specific charges at hand, the second amen covers a whole bunch more cases that weren't specifically, she wasn't specifically warned about, and also the Allah and the Shvua. Here now, Rabbi Meir has a slightly different understanding of, like, it's amen that I didn't do it in the past and amen that I won't do it in the future. Rabbi Meir Omer, amen shelo nitmeti, amen shelo et ame. That's how he understands the oath that she's supposed to be taking, which is like, which is in part, not only have I not cheated on my husband, I will not cheat on my husband in the future. I'm taking an oath now to make that the case. The point of the warning is the husband needs a specific charge to bring against her and a specific man to be referring to in order to get her into this situation. But once she's here and, like, they're about to, they've, you know, erased the name of God and they're about, she's about to drink it, I don't think it undercuts the warning per se if it covers everything else as well. Because I think the point of the specific warning is to provide a higher bar. You can't, and you also can't say to your wife at all. Like a husband can't say to her, to his wife, you can't see any men at all. Like that's totally forbidden. Like that would be grounds for immediate divorce. This is also relevant to the curses. Also, sort of covers some of the things that are under this oath in a certain sense. But also, it's it could be a little broader about what one can make stipulations about in contracts, marriage contracts. So we'll see that. Hakol shavin she'ino matne ima lo al kodem shetitares v'lo al me'achar shetitares. It's impossible. Everyone agrees, but you can't make an additional stipulation with her before she was engaged or after she was engaged, or after she was divorced. Notice that the cases that are covered here are engaged or betrothed, I should say, married, and then the same thing for the lever, like the you're waiting for the bond to be severed or consummated, and then the bond is consummated. It does not cover anything before betrothal or after divorce. Like if the oath doesn't cover anything, if they then subsequently get divorced, the oath doesn't cover anything under those circumstances. She's totally beyond his power and no longer bound by this oath. Even according to Rabbi Meir, right? The Hakol Shavin is, this includes Rabbi Meir. When Rabbi Meir says, I will not defile myself, what that means in the future, it means while I'm married, not after I'm divorced. After I'm divorced, I can do whatever I want. I'm no longer bound by anything that I said in this oath. Nistaral acher v'nitmit v'achar kach hechzira lo hayamat naima. So because of that, you'll find that if she got divorced, then she went off and secluded with the man that she was warned about, and then afterwards they got remarried. That's irrelevant. That was not under the conditions of the oath. Lo hayamat neima. She was not. There was nothing conditioned about that. There was nothing stipulated about that with her. Zehaklal. This is the principle, the general rule. Kol shetiba'el v'lo hayta arusalo lo hayamat neima. Anyone with whom she has sex that is not forbidden, that she wasn't forbidden to, that's not under this oath at all, not covered under this thing. The reason I say this might be slightly broader, because this language of matne, of stipulations, is really about legal contracts and not about the oath per se. It's a much broader language. And it is also true that, like, if you're trying to do a ketubah, you can't force your partner to do things when they're beyond your control. That's also true of the ketubah as well. So for after divorce or before betrothal, there's nothing you can really do in a ketubah to force actions. So but here specifically we're talking about this oath. The oath covers only the things that happened while they were married. If they were no longer married, and like the man that she was secluded with was totally permitted to her, that doesn't matter, wasn't covered by the oath. She'll never be in trouble for that. That's the end of chapter 2. So now we're going to continue the narrative. She could not remarry the husband if she married someone else in between. Yes, that's correct. Yes, it's forbidden to get remarried to someone if you've been married to someone else in the meantime. But this case is when she was secluded with that man and then came back but not married. Okay. There's an offering that goes along with this. We saw this, the Minchat Zikaron, Minchat Kena'ot, this jealousy offering or the remembrance offering of some kind of grain of barley, which we talked about a little bit last time. So it says it here. If you're looking over here, the husband brings his wife to the priest and brings her sacrifice upon her. By the way, this is probably the scriptural hook for why she carries the sacrifice. Because aleha could mean about her or literally on her. So about her would be the korbanah on her behalf, the korban on her behalf. Aleha literally would be she has to bring it herself. She has to carry it. And I think they are understood aleha there literally. Great, so it talks about the offering there. And then they do the whole cursing ceremony. After which she drinks, it seems. Well, actually, it doesn't say she drinks. It's just saying what happens if she drinks. They write the curses. Now, here she drinks, sorry. Here she drinks. And then the lakacha kohen biyata isha et mincha takanaot vehinifa ta mincha lefne Adonai. Then the kohen takes her hand, and they both sort of wave the, takes from her hand, and we'll see this becomes literal in a second. And he waves the offering before God and brings it to the mizbeach. Vekamatza kohen mina mincha et ezkarata. He takes a handful, kamatza kmitza. The priest takes a handful from the grain, and hiktira mizbecha, makes it turn to smoke on the altar, and then afterwards he makes the wife drink. So there's a bit of ambiguity as opposed to actually which happens first, the offering or the drinking. It's actually not totally obvious. It sort of flips back and forth. It says here, v'hishkai taisha edmei hamarim ha'ma'ararim. This, it says here, it's that he makes her drink. And then it says again here, and that here's where he made her drink. So it's not totally obvious. Women were allowed on the temple to sacrifice them, like a couple I do with the chicken. Yes, well, remember, this is all happening on the Nicanor gate. So they're not in the main courtyard yet. I think the priest would probably go alone into the altar, as we'll see in a second, and do the sprinkling, the scattering. Okay. Hayan notel et minchata mitoch kfifa mitzrit v'notzna l'toch kli sharet v'notzna al yada. So this is what we talked about before, the Egyptian basket. So now the priest takes her mincha from the Egyptian basket that we talked about before, and put it in a ministering vessel, a temple vessel, but not na aliyada, and he places it upon her hand, and then v'choy meniach yado mitachteha u'minifa. Then he sort of takes her hand, and they wave it together. So the kometz is in her hand, his hand is behind her hand, and they do the waving together. At the Nicanor gate, it seems. And this is a literal reading of this. So not just he takes from her hand, but like takes her hand. It's an extremely literal reading there. They wave the offering or over the head, or he just raise it up. I think they wave the offering overhead. I'm not sure what the difference is necessarily, but yeah, they would. I think it's some real waving. Okay, by the way, we talked last time about the ambiguity about whether it's the husband doing something or the priest doing something, and some people were like, Neusner and Blackman says this, but the commentaries say this. Anyway, it turns out this is actually a site of a massive machloket as to who this haya refers to in the commentaries, whether it refers to the husband or the priest, but I think it makes sense to refer to the priest, so there you go. No, the priest does not normally give an assist to wave offerings, and it's necessarily because she's a woman. I think it's specific to the sota. The priests would normally do the waving by themselves, regardless of who it is. It means the kohen is actually touching the hand of the woman. Yes, correct, Miriam. And the Talmud Yerushalmi apparently has a bit of a flip out about this, for reasons that you might understand. Given that, like, the whole premise of this is that it's like the whole premise. By the way, the sota ritual in many ways is like a thing which depends on gender segregation to a certain extent, which is like the whole anxieties that people have about this sort of ritual is basically just because men and women don't interact in public that often. And that's like part of why the warning is such a big deal, and why the events leading up to the warning are such a big deal, and why the ceremony is so supercharged, both positively and negatively. Exactly, that's exactly the point. The moments when you have gender segregation, the moments when you have gender mixing can be very dangerous. If you're in a society with clear segregation between the genders, when you mix, it becomes charged in ways that it wouldn't be otherwise. So that's why the Yerushalmi has a freak out about the priest touching the woman's hand, whereas for us, it might be a bit more like, okay, sure, whatever, touches a woman's hand. Great, so now they've waved the offering, they sort of wave it together. Yeah, I don't know any other offering that does this sort of dual action, because also most of the other offerings are waved, I think, in the temple itself, and this is still, we're still at the gate. They did not have, it depends what you mean by the concept of Nagia. The concept of Shomer Nagia, of like not touching members of the opposite sex, absolutely they did not have at all. That is a crazy chumrah, crazy modern chumrah. That has nothing to do with traditional Jewish law. But they were very nervous about gender mixing in general. As I said, in a society where gender segregation is the norm, gender mixing becomes charged in a way that it wouldn't be otherwise. Okay, so now, Hinif v'higish, kamatz v'hiktir, v'sha'ar ne'echa la kohanim. Now, he brings the so once he's waved the thing, he waves it, brings it now into the altar, takes the handful from the temple vessel, and hiktir turns it into smoke, turns it into incense. The rest of the barley that was not burnt on the altar could be eaten by the priests, as is normally the case with these kinds of offerings. It's a little bit ironic because before we made the whole point about how the barley is because she did the deed of an animal, and therefore the barley is like animal food. So it's a bit ironic that we made the whole big deal about that earlier, and now the priests are just going to get to eat it. But there you go. Since the priest can't officiate his tameh, the fact that he's offering it means that he hasn't had an emission in 24 hours or more. When he's a functioning kohen, he is celibate, perhaps considered beyond sexual activity. Yes, I guess that's probably true. Yeah, right. So that's in the way they have negiah, they have touching concerns, which is around genital discharges and things in the Torah like that, and like various other tumor things. So yeah, so certainly the Kohen would have to be not impure at this time. Okay, and now we see that there's an argument about which order, as I mentioned before, it's a bit ambiguous, whether the drinking happens first or the offering happens first. And yeah, here we go. Yeah, so the priest could have turned it into beer. Yeah, I assume they didn't eat it the way it was. Okay. The anonymous majority opinion is they would first make her drink and afterwards bring her offering. Rabbi Shimon Omer, right, which makes sense if you just go through the order of the verses. Let's just make sure we understand where that opinion is coming from. If you just go through the order of the verses, that's what it says. It says you do the whole cursing thing, you write the things, you make her drink, you take the mincha. Seems pretty clear. And therefore, like this over here is some kind of, where it says that she makes her drink again, is some kind of repetition, resumptive repetition. It just sort of continues from where we started. From where we were before. Yeah, but the order of the verses is pretty clear. Drink, offering. Oh, and then let me resume the topic that I was talking about when it came to drinking. So that's what the anonymous majority opinion has. But Rabbi Shimon disagrees. He thinks makrivet minchata v'achar kach hayamashka. They would bring they would offer the mincha first, the grain offering first, and afterwards would force her to drink. Shneamar v'achar yashke et haisha et hamayin. So look at this this verse over here. Achar yashke et ha'isha et ha'mayim. He focuses on this word achar. This word achar clearly means that you do the mincha and then you make her drink. So this So the order of the verses is nothing. Don't. It's clearly says achar. But I just want to point out that both of them have a leg to stand on because it's really not obvious from the psukim themselves. But what Rabbi Meir does think is im hishkav achar kach hikriv et minchata k'sheira. If the order was flipped, that they actually gave her the waters first and afterwards they brought the mincha, that would be fine. Ideally, they would do it in the opposite order. They would do the offering first, then the drinking. But if they did it the opposite way, the point of these verses being ambiguous, he thinks the ambiguity is about that if you did it either way, you'd be fine. But ideally, you should do it one way and not the other way. Wrong reference numbers in Kati and Yuzna. Fascinating. Yeah, so they're just trying to deal with the particularities, peculiarities of the verses. I just want to say that, like, this is a pretty fundamental disagreement, which certainly tells you, like if you'd ever seen a Sotah ritual, you would know which way it was supposed to go. I guess maybe unless it was always drinking and then offering, in which case Rabbi Shimon would think that was less than ideal, but fine, and the Tanakhama would think that was correct. But nonetheless, this seems like a fairly fundamental disagreement that if they'd ever actually seen such a ceremony in their entire lives, they would know which way it was. So this, again, seems to be mostly about the reading the verses of the Torah and less rooted in any kind of reality. Also, Rabbi Shimon was probably did not remember anything. Yeah, so that's exactly what I'm trying to say. How common were the sort of ceremonies? I thought they were rare. Yeah, that's exactly the thing. I think that you'll definitely find the people who will say, actually, it never happened. So I have no idea how common it is. I don't know if we have any good evidence one way or the other. I'm not sure if you'd expect any good evidence one way or the other. Here certainly suggests that what they're mostly focused on is the verses and less so any knowledge of reality. Okay, I think we're going to finish up here. I don't have time to get into the next Mishnah. So thank you, everyone. Shabbat shalom.